This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Thanks to Resonant Frequency Radio for another great show, playing tracks and chatting with Collingwood artists. Welcome to Living Free, a one-hour show in which we highlight one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drugs, alcohol, gambling and food addictions. Our guests share their recovery story and highlight that shared experience saves lives. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 on the AM dial or 3CR on digital radio or maybe even live streaming on 3cr.org.au. My name's Michael and I'm joined in the studio by Chrissy, who's going to my guest, and she's going to share her experience of recovery from alcoholism with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. Before we do that, I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and to acknowledge that the material and spiritual connection of Aboriginal people to this land was stolen from them. Now, before we start, I'd like to remind you that Living Free Show may involve discussion of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm and family violence, so please practice self-care and care of others whilst listening. Welcome, Chrissy.
Thank you, Michael.
It's great to have you and great to have you come into the studio and join me here today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. Okay, we like to start our show by asking our guests to tell us a little bit about their upbringing and about their background, just to sort of highlight the fact that addiction hits anybody and everybody, yeah. And there's no common story of life. It's just so what was it like growing up as Chrissy?
Well, okay, to start with, my father was alcoholic and I split when I was about two. Their relationship sort of went south and he moved up geographically north, so he moved up to Queensland, a couple of thousand k's away, and I didn't really have a lot to do with him, to be honest. But yeah, I see a lot of myself in him, you know, as an adult, that's for sure. Certainly certainly my alcoholism. I didn't know Dad a lot. My mum remarried, and from about the age of 3 to 8, there was a lot of family violence. It was a scary kind of unpredictable life. I never sort of knew exactly what to expect, but my mind began to tell me that it wasn't going to be good, you know. And what I learned to do was really look at people's behaviours and not so much judge, but I like to examine them and I like to assess risk, you know, and I do that in my day job today. That's what I did as a child. And so I spent a lot of time trying to manage my circumstances, my surroundings, manage, you know, the impact or the outcome of either behaviours, you know, choices that I'd made or things I'd do. Because unfortunately at that age, you know, I did take a lot of responsibility or took on a sense of responsibility for that violence that took place in the home, even though as an adult now I can see, yeah, that wasn't the reality, but that's what it felt like. So yeah, that was sort of in a nutshell my childhood. But my mum was pretty impacted as well, and I never really gave her a lot of, not so much credit, but allowance for that. I sort of always wanted my mum, I suppose, to be, you know, to show up more for me than she was able to. My sister and I were out of home by the time I was 14 and my sister was 12. And it's interesting. I remember the conversations that she was having with a family friend who was down in Melbourne, and we were living in Brisbane at the time. And I knew that my mum was getting prepared to send my sister and I away. Mm. And I could hear her sort of talking about logistics and what have you. And when I look back on the teenager that I had become, that, you know, that had emerged, I suppose, out of that childhood, I see today that I was a damaged individual at that time. I was violent. I kicked in, you know, you know, bunkers of local service stations, and I ran away from home, and the police were always showing up, and the police would show up to my girls' school that I went to. So, you know, I actually went to some really excellent schools. That's what my parents did pay for. But yeah, I was out of control, and eventually my mum was unable to maintain, you know, the parenting role. And at the time, in my sort of immature your mind, that kind of felt like such a huge rejection and abandonment, and it was absolutely a wound at that time. And I just remember thinking once I landed in Melbourne with my sister, number one, I felt very responsible for my sister.
So you think that a little bit of your childhood was, it's a really short childhood if you've taken on responsibilities at such a young age?
Well, in retrospect, yeah. I mean, I guess it was in a lot of ways, and I always wanted to, you know, make sure that mum was okay and my sister was okay. And I suppose, yeah, I don't sit in a victim stance today, but it did sort of play into the young person that I became, and it certainly actually it played right into adulthood as well, and I needed relief from that sort of state of being.
Yes. So how old were you when you drank? When we experienced the joy of alcohol, the thing that goes, wow, yeah. This is it. This is a thing. This has been missing from my life.
Oh, the absolute answer to all of my, you know, it was my solution for life. Absolutely. As I said, I was out of control, but I was also someone who couldn't articulate what was wrong, and I didn't know what was wrong. And it's only much later that I've, you know, realised. But I always, it just gave me such a sense of relief and a way of fitting into the world where I no longer had to worry about what you thought of me, whether or not, you know, yeah, you liked me, whether or not I liked you. Like I just, after the second or third drink, I just got what I'd call the efforts. I won't swear, but, you know, and it was all, life was going to be okay. And I no longer had to worry about what you were thinking. And I certainly didn't have to worry about my greatest fear. And my greatest fear was that one day I'd have to, or I might re-experience that sort of separation, that abandonment feeling. And I pretty much made a conscious decision to never allow myself to get so close to somebody ever again that I would put myself in a position to be harmed, you know. And if I had detected from a distance that you might not care for me the way that I care for you or what have you, bang, walls up, shut down, run, you know. Yep. And that's how I got through life. And so, yeah, alcohol really aided that way of living. I bought 18 whole Doc Martens. I wore dark makeup. I got a flannelette shirt and a big F off on my forehead. And I just thought, you know, I just wanted the world to think, you can't get at me, you know.
So how old were you then?
So I was about 14 then, and that went on until...
All the way at 14. It's the age, isn't it? If we hang around in AA long enough, it's the age.
Yeah.
It's like I held out. 13 to 14, I started drinking. You go, I held out as long as I could.
Absolutely, as long as I could. And you know, at my very first drink, Bundy Rum in Brisbane, they all drink Bundy. And I got a bottle of 375ml, and all my friends at this, my cousin's party actually, were saying, Chrissy, you got to mix it with Coke. And I said, I've never had this stuff, but I am not watering this down. Yep. Like, I just know that, yeah, I knew from the, before it even hit my lips, that it wasn't going to be for the taste. And yeah, to this day, I can't even stand the smell of Bundy. But yeah, I drank that whole bottle, absolutely was annihilated, probably made an idiot of myself, and woke up the next day and went, let's go.
Like, I'll be doing this again.
I have got, yeah, a solution for living. And I in a certain way, I often say this, that I look back and alcohol really served a purpose. You know, I regret some of the things that happened. I don't regret alcohol, and I don't regret alcoholism. It's been the most incredible experience since. So
Yeah, cool. So okay, so you found it. You found the solution, in early teen years or mid teen years, and my experience with alcohol is that it's a progressive disease. If I suffer from this thing, that when I put it in my body, that I can't control how much I take, and I know that, but I also have this thing in my mind that tells me next time, you know, I'm not even trying to stop at that stage because it's fun. It's like it's doing the job that it needs to do. But at some stage, when did it stop doing the job you wanted it to do?
Look, I was running into, you know, a fair bit of, when I say trouble, certainly trouble in my relationships, in my workplace, and, you know, my social life, like in my 20s. I met my husband, who's here today. I met him when I was 24. He was the first person who'd ever said to me, Chrissy, I think you drink differently to other people. I had known that. Innately I knew that. My mum had said that I was just like my dad, you know, you're alcoholic and da-da-da. But I'd learned to say to mum, yeah, I am. So what are you going to do about it? Like I'd learnt not to argue because it just meant that I didn't have to, you know, resist and they had nowhere to go with it. But yeah, but my husband was the first person to go, it's weird. Like, yeah, there's something different. So I think the biggest turning point for me with my drinking was after having got married, got the white picket fence, you know, tried to have somewhat, you know, normal looking life on the outside, having three beautiful children, being able to stop drinking throughout pregnancy for the most part, and, you know, telling myself that I can't possibly have a problem if I can put it down for 9 months, then I, you know, I can't be an alcoholic, and realizing that every time I picked it up, it progressed, it got worse, you know, it got a lot worse. And all I'd wanted my whole life genuinely was to be a really good mum and to stay married and do all of the things that I felt that my mum hadn't been able to achieve, which sounds awful now, but that's how, you know, that's how I thought in my mind. I thought, I want to stay married. I want to be committed. I want to be loyal, and I want to be a really wonderful mother. And the reality was that alcohol was a huge barrier to that. Wasn't happening. So yeah, that's it was no longer fun.
So it was no longer fun, and but you're still doing it. And that's, and my experience with that is that it drives us insane. That's the problem, is that we've got this where our actions are showing us exactly how we feel. Like I tell my family they come first, and then my actions show me, and it shows them that that they're not coming first.
Yeah.
So where are you at with that?
Where am I at now?
At that, no, at, oh, that, no, time, at that stage, time. At that time, you're
that
sort of
stage, yeah.
You're in it.
Look, the self sort of, you know, loathing and the frustration at myself, and having no idea why. I knew that I'd lost, you know, the power of choice. I knew that I no longer chose to drink. I could sit in denial and say, oh yeah, I make these choices, and yeah, you know, but deep down intrinsically I knew that actually I was doing something beyond my own will. And that was a really frightening place to be. It was really frightening because I knew that actually I was slowly being backed into a corner where ultimately I was going to have to make a decision. And just, yeah, as I was further backed into that corner, I became more and more frightened, probably drank more than I ever did, and was eventually, yeah, given an ultimatum.
Yeah, so, okay, well, we're going to take a break just from there. Welcome back. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio. This is the Living Free Show, and today we're talking to Chrissy about her recovery from alcoholism with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. We'd like to encourage our listeners to become regular donors to 3CR. By becoming a regular donor, your ongoing support ensures that we can continue to provide a platform for community issues and struggles. Jump online and go to 3cr.org.au to become a regular donor, or call the station during business hours on 9419 8377. Before the break, you gave us some insight into, you know, the upbringing, and then, you know, what it looked like in your 20s, when 20s, 30s, 20s, 20s, you're young. So, you know, what it looked like when you had kids, and, you know, you weren't there, you weren't being the parent that you wanted to be, but maybe you had it all looking good on the outside. And I said that was my experience. So if I can get line the ducks up and make it look good on the outside, doesn't matter that I'm dying on the inside.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so what happened next? What was the thing that brought you to your knees, and what then happened? We're just going to sort of skip over that. And that, just to say that, you know, if you're interested in hearing the whole of Chrissy's story, she's been a guest on the show many years ago, and I'll put a link to that program on the podcast. So, yeah, so what brought you to your knees, and what happened next?
Look, what brought me to my knees, basically the only thing that would have ever brought me to my knees, which really was facing death. You know, honestly, I knew that I was likely not going to survive much longer at drinking the levels of booze I was drinking. I could feel it. I felt my mental health was non-existent. My physical health was really suffering. I had peripheral neuritis in my hands and feet. I had cramping all over my body, just in places where I didn't know I had muscles. I had a really sore enlarged liver, and all of these things. I'd been to uni for a little bit, for just 5 minutes, as I tended to do, done a bit of a nursing degree, and I knew what was wrong with me. I knew what was likely wrong with me, and I began to realise that I couldn't deny that to myself anymore, that even though I'd always said that I had a bit of a death wish and I'm not here for a long time, I'm here for a good time, the reality was I was being faced with that. And I thought, now I've got this beautiful husband, these children, I've actually got something to live for, which was pretty terrifying. You know, I never wanted something to live for. And yeah, what was I going to do?
Yeah, cool. So rehab?
Yeah, rehab. So rang around one night in blackout, no idea that I'd done it. Started to get some phone calls the next day, you know, thinking, why am I getting these cold calls?
Have to explain. So blackout? Yeah. Was it blackout?
Oh, so blackout drinking. Yeah, absolutely no memory of what I did. I was obviously able to function whilst being insanely drunk or insanely impacted by alcohol, not necessarily insanely drunk. I could black out after a couple of drinks. But yeah, I was able to function enough to make a phone call, leave messages, emails, what have you, and have absolutely zero recollection of doing
that. It's a foreign thing to people who drink normally. We throw the word blackout around and thinking people understand. And if you haven't had an experience, you go, what?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, actually, my body keeps going and my memory's turned off.
Yeah,
and then, you know, I'm lucky enough to be old enough to not have drunk through mobile phones and social media, because I'm like, I listen to people talk about, you know, I had to go through my phone and see who I called yesterday. Yeah. And I didn't have that. Like, I have complete memory of everybody I offended. I didn't black out drink at all. I was completely aware. I still have the heebie-jeebies where I go, when I think about a particular conversation or something I've done drunk, and I go, So you're in rehab. Rehab, you know, isn't the solution, but it's a gateway to a solution.
It is. You know, I needed to be separated from alcohol. And as you said, it's certainly not cure, but at that time I needed to be medically assisted while I did that to safely do it. Front-loaded, with a whole heap of Valium. And it was funny, I'd never really had diazepam before, but started me at 100 milligrams on the Monday and they slowly tapered off. And by the Thursday, tried to go from 40 to nothing. And my nursing expertise kicked in again. And I had the nurses call the head doctor to say that you cannot drop me from 40 milligrams to nothing. You've got to give me one more night of 20. Now, I haven't touched Valium, but I knew that I was going to be all alone in my head. And I just needed 24 hours more. And you know, that's just the nature of my addiction. It doesn't really matter what gets me out of my head, quite frankly. I mean, alcohol's my choice,
your drug of no choice.
I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right, exactly. But yeah, when it comes to my greatest fear is myself.
Being sober, like when hey, if you drop me down from 40 to nothing, that means I'm sober. My God, now I'm in trouble.
You don't understand.
I understand I'm in a rehab with a bunch of other people who are exactly the same position, but you guys don't understand that. I just don't do sober.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I can be really obnoxious when I'm in that state, and I still can be today. Like when I'm scared and I'm in fear, I'll start throwing around what I think is knowledge and
Tell the story of a rehab story. I love the rehab story about Chris taking in your husband taking the one of the kids into the rehab with the bee sting.
Oh my gosh. So 2 weeks in, it's a 28-day, you know, stay, and I wasn't allowed any phone calls, anything, any contact for 2 weeks. But at the 2 week mark, family's allowed to come in. So my husband brought our three children in. I have a 3-year-old and 15-month-old twin boys, and they're just absolutely beautiful. And I'd already said that, you know, people had called me selfish, like the counsellors and what have you. And I said, look, I object to that. But anyway, in walks my husband and with the pram, and I look at my twin boys, and one of them looks a little different and I said, what on earth has happened, you know, to Harry? His eyes were really swollen, or between his eyes was really swollen. And Chris said, oh yeah, he was out the front crawling around and he got stung by a bee. And what it looked like to me, again bringing this nursing background in, was fetal alcohol syndrome. And I said to Chris, my pride and ego, I said, how dare you bring my children in looking like that? Everyone's going to think that I drank during pregnancy. And oh my God, It's awful to think of myself.
The things we laugh about, we go,
it's just gross. Yeah. It's really gross. But anyway, and the poor man, left and went home, and I just said, by the way, it's blanket apology. Apparently there's this amends process and just blanket, you know, I'm not going to revisit this over.
I won't be revisiting this at all. Yeah, how dare you do it to me? You bet. Okay, so come out of rehab, you get introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in the rehab?
In the rehab, yeah. I identified for my very first meeting. It was just incredible. It was actually in the rehab, and there was a guest speaker. She was probably around my age, and she talked about being on the Great Ocean Road on Nepean Highway, but Beach Road up sort of around Mentone area, and that's where I had lived. And she talked about hitting a man drink driving and killing him. And I just remember thinking, I haven't done that, but I just so know how capable I am of doing that, or had been. And, you know, the only, like, just save for a few scrapes. I just got out. I don't know why that wasn't my fate, but I really identified with that. And I knew I was in the right place. They told me to get a sponsor. They told me to do the steps. And, of course, I wasn't having a bar of it. Like, I'd spent my whole life, you know, since 14, taking care of things. I can manage this. I don't need people. I'm certainly not asking for help. And, yeah, spent almost 12 months relapsing in Alcoholics Anonymous. Every time I left a meeting, I'd leave for 2 or 3 days or a week, and within days I'd be drinking. And it's a really scary, horrible place to be. You know,
it stuffs up your drinking, doesn't it? Just stuffs up, takes all the fun out of it.
It stuffs it right up. And yeah, there's way too much identification and I guess knowledge around the disease. But, you know, knowledge is not the cure either. I need to apply it. I need to not just apply it. It needs to land. You know, I need to believe it wholeheartedly that I'm alcoholic. I cannot manage my own life.
Yeah, it's the first step. So that, and the thing is that I don't have any power over alcohol when I drink, because it gets out of control when I put it in me physically. But then I don't have any power over it when I don't drink, because I have a mind that wants to keep dragging me back to it. What's the saying? My brain would have killed my body years ago, except it needed it for transport. And so the brain just keeps leading me back, thinking, I know better, I know better, I know better. And then pride and fear just get in the way. So when was the surrender?
So, with that head that wanted to kill me, the surrender was I left work on a Friday sick. Well, I said I was sick. I wasn't sick. I left at 1 o'clock. My children were in childcare. I got as far as a couple of hundred metres down the road, and I saw, you know, the local pub, and I thought, I'm just going to duck in just for one or two drinks. And I meant that, because it was 1 p.m. in the afternoon, had the shakes, and I knew I had to get the kids by about 3, 5, something like that. And I don't know who picked up my children that night, you know, and I absolutely, my intention was to stop for one or two. Don't know who picked the kids up. I know it wasn't me. I don't know what time I got home. And the next morning, I had to take my daughter to a concert. I'd booked those tickets in sobriety, and she had really looked forward to it. It was a Fairies concert in the Outer East, and with my whole mother's group. And they started calling me in the morning going, Chrissy, where are you? Where are you? And I realised that, oh, my God, I've forgotten about this thing that I've been talking about with my daughter for months. And I jumped out of bed. Went to the toilet, was sick in the toilet, grabbed a tutu, grabbed a wand, and grabbed my daughter out of bed. And I never forget it. She had bed hair at the back, like that little kind of, you know, knot. Threw her into the car, got her into this theatre, and she ran down the front with her friends, and she was dancing with the Fairies and what have you. And I just looked up, and for the first time ever in this dark hall, I said, God, if you're there, I'm dying of alcoholism and I need you. And from that day forward, that was my surrender. From that day forward, things started to look up.
Yeah, because, God, my experience with a power greater than myself is that when I ask for help and I'm willing to accept help, that it works. The willingness to accept help. I'm self-sufficient, and I believe, and I pick up some street smarts along the way, and I have some survival skills that have certainly got me to the place where I'm at. For me, I was 41, but that space I got, actually, those skills were invaluable to be able to get me there, otherwise I was dead man. And then eventually I've got to go, actually, it's not working. So what am I going to do? And AA has the solution to that. Like, we come in and it doesn't look like the solution. Like the solution that's on offer, it looks like it's not drinking club. And you're going to hang out with these people who don't drink. And how miserable is that? Yeah. Listen to their miserable drinking stories. Tell them how they're going to bitch and complain about not drinking.
Yeah.
And you and I sort of fell into a group out in the eastern suburbs that didn't talk about not drinking. They talked about how they were going to live their lives differently. We've been friends for a long time, but about that behaviour change that's required.
Yeah.
I needed to have a complete psychic change or a complete change in the way I do life. And then the drinking problem has been removed, and that's weird, because I've never looked for that.
Just so bizarre. Yeah, so bizarre. But you just described it so beautifully. That's exactly what happened. I just, you know, I was levelling of my pride. I had no other solution, no other option. So, you know, the book says that God either is or he isn't, and what was your choice to be? And I didn't like that, you know, that option. I was always looking for something behind door three, but there wasn't anything. So yes, I met you, 14, 15 years ago, and I often say to you, and you are one of my closest friends, and I'm just really grateful for your absolute both barrels honesty that you've always, you know, given me. And I've been incredibly grateful for it. That's the way I need to be spoken to. I will manipulate the situation if I feel like if I can, you know, if you're dancing around or whatever. And you've never got on board with my BS, basically, and you've never reinforced my distorted thinking. And that's absolutely what I need, because it's frightening. The alternative is frightening. But so I met people like you. I met a woman who put her hand out one morning at a 7 a.m. meeting when I was bawling my eyes out, saying, "I know I'm dying, and I just don't know why everyone else is smiling, and I'm just finding this so difficult." And she said, "Would you like a temporary sponsor?" And I really think that those words genuinely saved my life. The pride, the ego, the fear of taking or accepting some help from anyone. I don't think it could have got through in any other way. So I said, "Yes, I would really like that." And the truth is, that woman, she looked like my mother. She sounded like my mother. She was born in the same year as my mother. I'm not sure if my mum was going to listen to this, but anyway, but she sort of was a little bit loud and obnoxious like my mother.
But she had a great sense of humour.
Great sense of humour. And, you know, when I look back, the 14-year-old girl in me, who was actually in a 34-year-old body by this stage, was looking for mum. And, yeah, so it was the perfect. It wasn't a perfect storm. It was it's exactly what I needed. That woman walked me through a process of recovery that was just, it's so hard to articulate, mind-blowing. It gave me the recipe for life. And
I was going to go grab some stuff out of the book, but then so when I refer to the book, we mean Alcoholics Anonymous, the book. And so the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is based on a book that was written back in the 1930s, the first 100 people that got sober, getting or stayed sober. I guess the language, anybody can get sober. It's the issue is staying sober. And so they've written a textbook that actually details what they did to stay sober. And we just talked about the God thing, which is usually the thing that drives people away initially. They come in and see the oldie language on the banners that are hanging in the room, and the font of the calligraphy of the word God in the Serenity Prayer, and they go, "Oh my God, it's a cult." And it's religious. But you know, the language of it is when we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis we could not postpone or evade, we had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? And most people, when we come into AA, we're coming in with a complete lack of choices. We've tried a lot of other things, and then it jumps onto the next page. And this is in a chapter in the book that's specifically designed to be aimed at the people who don't want a God. And AA doesn't have a God. AA just has a sort of shows me the need for some sort of power that isn't me, because based on myself, I can't get in. But the language, I love it, saw that actually we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman and child is the fundamental idea of God. And it may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other, it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and the miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. And, you know, I come to AA and I see miracles every day. Like, it's an astounding thing to watch other people's lives change. Mm. So, yeah, we'll talk about, you know, the step process is, you know, I admitted powerlessness over alcohol and that I'm powerless and that my life's unmanageable. I come to believe that a power that's greater than me, whatever that is, a group of drunks, it could be the people in the rooms, it could be AA in general, it could be whatever you choose to be. Hey, I'm going to try something different, and then I'm going to make a decision in step three to do something different. And the decision I made was to go ahead and do the rest of the steps.
Yeah.
Due to, not because it's a good bloke decision, but because it's, you know, I had no choice. Like, I'm going to neck myself. Yeah. And that was the thing. I was going to sober. You know, the problem couldn't be drinking, because I wasn't drinking anymore, and now I'm still miserable. I better do something else. There's got to be something else on offer.
Yeah.
And then, you know, what's in, so you had this process of having a look at yourself in step four.
And, you know, I was the same in that the whole God idea just absolutely, I'm sure that was part of, you know, the reason, not reason, but the what made it so difficult for me to surrender that first year, because I just really thought that, you know, that people were trying to get one over me, and I just think I'm smarter than that. And yeah, I love that part deep down in every man, woman and child is the fundamental idea of God, and it's one of my favourite parts of the book, because I do really relate to that, and I have my own kind of connection to that in that I've got really vivid memories of childhood and hiding in wardrobes and hiding in cupboards when, you know, there was stuff going on at home and being really scared, and we didn't have like even Walkmans back then or radios, so I'd put my fingers in my ears and I'd hum just to buzz out that noise, because I was frightened, and I didn't come from a religious background whatsoever, and I'm not religious today, but I used to pray to a God of my, I guess, misunderstanding, and just hope that there was something out there. And what would happen by just some freak of nature, but some old lady from next door, and this happened in several houses that I lived in, she would come and she would knock on the door, and then she'd say to my mum, I'll take the children, and, you know, we'd go into some random's house. And I'll never forget the smell of those spare bedrooms of the old ladies, and the nylon-y kind of, you know, polyester bedspreads, and the op shop smell and what have you, and I'd hear the fighting next door. So my point is, I had some connection to a faith, a power bigger than me, a desperate need for, you know, the universe, whatever it was. And to me, my recovery has been reintroducing me back to that initial connection that had broken somewhere along the line.
Isn't that amazing that we go back and through our lives, we go back and look at our lives and our perspective of our lives change? Like that's what the gift of recovery is for me. I can actually have a completely different perspective about the way life has actually unfolded. You know, through my eyes when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was happening to me. Now I get to, you know, the language in that bit I first read, which said the self-imposed crisis and the position that I put myself in based on my behaviours, and I can see why it unfolded the way it did. I met a woman who told me she liked me, and that was enough. And I held on for dear life, and I lied and did anything just so she wouldn't leave. And she held me off the ground for, you know, 20 years and stopped me crashing. But coming to AA and having a chance to look at that stuff through, you know, in step four we write an inventory, and I guess inventory is a funny word, not being, but we took stock of our lives and we looked at them and went, these are the behaviours that I do that don't work, and I keep doing them. And I'm expecting a different result. And going, oh, actually that doesn't work, and it's affected my relationships along the way. And then I become willing to change. I share that with somebody else.
I was definitely a runner. Like I was a runner. As I said, my husband's here, and when I met him, I'd lived in, you know, 45 different homes by the time I met him when I was 24. And I had learnt that when things get tough, or if you suspect that this is not going to work out, you go. And so when I got married, I was so, so committed, but I will say that a tiny part of me, which was a fear kind of, I don't know, avoidant response, was that, you know, when I do detect that he's on his way out, I had every intention of just heading off, you know, around Australia, and that was going to be my life. I was going to be a bit of a hobo, and because no one was ever going to want to be with me forever, and, you know, power greater than me put this man who was, you know, now just the most wonderful person in my entire life in my path. And gee whiz, like, I don't know, I just can't thank him enough. He's been really loving and tolerant the whole time, and he's shown me what healthy relationships look like. You know, he's shown me that even when things get tough, like, that doesn't mean you pack up, you know, your bat and ball and run, although every part of me instinctively wants to do that, because I will just do anything to avoid that pain. And what I know today at 14 years sober is that actually I can face my greatest fears, you know, some of my greatest fears, I can literally face them head on, and I can see them as these incredible opportunities today to grow, to heal, I don't know, it sounds, you know, corny, but to become more enlightened, just as in just to see the world and see myself for who I am.
Yeah, we're going to come back and we're going to talk about that. I'm just going to play a couple of community service announcements, and the first one is...
Is drinking costing you more than money? Alcoholics Anonymous provides a free and anonymous recovery service to anyone who wants to call it quits. Join millions of other alcoholics worldwide and take your first brave steps toward a new beginning. There are thousands of AA meetings happening every week across Australia. If you'd like to find your closest meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous or have any questions regarding this tried and tested treatment for alcoholism, call 1300 AAAAA, that's 1300 22 22 22, or visit aa.org.au. This community service announcement is sponsored by Alcoholics Anonymous.
You're listening to Living Free on 3CR People Powered Radio. If you'd like to listen to one of our many podcasts, then you can find us on your preferred podcast platform or just search for 3CR Living Free and check out our website. Today I'm talking with Chrissy about alcoholism and recovery with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so you've been sober, what, 14 years?
Yeah, 14 years. So 19th of November 2011, I got sober.
Yeah, cool. So what's life look like now? If the kids were... what, 3 and 18 months when you were in rehab, and then you got sober again about a year later?
Yeah.
So they're old.
They're old. Oh my gosh, and I'm so much older. But they are 19 and the twins are nearly 17. Just magnificent humans. Like I just can't believe, you know, that they've turned out just to be such great people.
I hope they're not listening.
Oh, don't worry, they won't. If they hear about Mum doing some radio show, they'll roll their eyes. Anyway.
I know that if one of your sons knew his name was mentioned earlier, he would definitely be...
Well, actually,
He would actually be into listening to his own name being said on the radio.
Yeah, that's right. But they're good kids. I just can't believe that I was able to, or recovery and the program have been able to facilitate basically me showing up to life and being responsible and doing the things that I say I'm going to do. But doing it with, complete love for these humans and they're wonderful kind of well-rounded people. And I just couldn't ask for anything more. That's just for today.
It'll change tomorrow.
Yeah, it will. Yeah. We've had challenging times as well. We've been through the teenage years and we're still in it a bit, but we made it through to the other side, and that's all down to, you know, I just cannot take any credit for that. Just like I can't take credit for my own recovery. If it were up to me, I'd be dead. So something else stepped in.
Yeah. You're happy to talk about the work you do?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So interesting from the background that you came from, to what you do in your life that funds a life.
Yeah. It's one of the greatest parts, you know, of my daily living now, my recovery. So I work in the family violence space. I work with men who use violence, and it's just, how do I just know that I'm in the right spot. I sort of deliver programs, men's behavior change programs, and some caring dads, and just some, you know, family violence programs. And I also deliver those programs one to one when there's a few kind of competing needs going on. So I get about 6 months with a certain, you know, man, and we get to get down to the real like causes and conditions of the way that, you know, the things in our lives that aren't working and what it's driven by. And even though their behaviours might be different to mine, they might not be that different, and I might drink and they might have drunk and they may not have, it's still driven by the same fears, the same insecurities, the same resentments, same need to control my surroundings, my world. And so I'm in this really unique spot where I get to, instead of coming to them like with a practitioner client kind of power imbalance, which is not good, it doesn't help anyone, and we find it hard to engage men that way, I get to sort of come from very early on and just give them a little bit of my background and say that I'm someone who's had to change my behavior significantly. Mm. And what an amazing thing, you know, being vulnerable, being honest, and what an amazing sort of outcome it's had, being able to get to that stage. And it doesn't happen overnight, but I can tell you the walls come down pretty quickly when you're able to just level with someone and there's no power imbalance. It's like, I'm just another human being who needs to change her behaviour as much as you do.
Yeah, you know? we're
you come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and the word God's all over the wall, and you think it's a religious thing, but it's actually a behaviour change program, and we drag our thinking and our thinking and our feelings with the behaviour. We act our way into better thinking, rather than trying to think, because the temptation is to work it out. Mm. And I watch, so many people come in and they're going to outsmart it, and they're just going to know better and arm myself with some knowledge and then I'll know better. Mm. And that's not how powerlessness works. If I'm powerless over it, I'm going to pick it up. That's what step one tells me, is that it doesn't tell me I can't drink. It tells me that I will drink. And then I'm now going to go and take some actions that don't look like the solution to the problem. Mm. I always joke about the fact that my problem is, it's not a visual medium, so it's difficult, but if the problem's sitting right in front of me, my job is to not look at the problem. My job is to go off and do the stuff that AA tells me to do, which is to go and think about other people and go and be useful to others and show up and do that. And a lot of my problems just aren't real. They just die of neglect when I'm not paying attention to them and poking them and manipulating them and mangling them and doing, and I just think I'll manage it. Mm. And every problem I manage gets worse. And I get further in it. The more Michael in my problems is, the worse it is. I walk away and just let it go, it doesn't mean I don't care, but I'm driven by fears of people, what other people think and things like that. And that's the whole program, is that I'm going to change my behaviours no matter what I'm feeling, no matter what I'm thinking. Mm. And what's happened for you? Has that worked for you?
Yeah, so you just said that AA is the best behaviour change program. You mentioned behaviour change, and I always say it's the best behaviour change program on the planet. And I have looked at a number of different sorts, but I guess when it comes to even in my daily work, like I don't call it Alcoholics Anonymous or the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous when I'm working with people. But by and large, and it doesn't matter, I've got a university degree and, these diplomas and I'm doing postgrad and whatever, I use the work and the experiences that I've had in AA when I'm working with men, and that is honestly what works. So, for example, like the amends process, we call it reparation, and that's fine, but we still go through that process and this stuff works. And even my being vulnerable and honest is part of that identification process, so they can identify with another human being. And start to lose some of that guilt, shame, remorse, because shame is something that is an enormous barrier. I think I'm doing a master's and I'm going to probably write a master's on the shame barrier with men. But what it does is, like, shame can only exist, in the dark, in the dark recesses. Like, it can't be exposed to light. It can't be exposed to other people and their experiences. It has to stay inside my mind and secret, and, as I said, in a dark place. And shame's quite different to guilt. Shame is what my self-belief system, the way that I think about myself as a person. So guilt says, oh, Chrissy, you've made a mistake. And shame says, Chrissy, you are a mistake. And I've definitely had that toxic shame kind of flavour to my existence since childhood. Anyway, so I'm able to really connect with men on that level, and to not judge. It's horrible, obviously. I mean, I've seen in real time, like, the impact of what takes place in homes. So I'm not condoning it for one second, because, it got my mother to the stage where she had no capacity to parent, but in saying that, I like to look at a problem and say, rather than, point blame or be too punitive about it, let's get down to, the facts, and let's look at some real behaviour change, and anything else I'm not interested in, frankly. Yeah. So, yeah.
And so, and you and I have a lot of fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a fellowship of people that people who I wouldn't have drunk with. At the end of my drinking, if you weren't drinking in my car and you weren't drinking in my garage, you weren't drinking with me.
Yeah.
There's nothing social about it. But, that's the thing, is we managed to be kind and loving and tolerant with people that we don't have a lot in common with.
Mm.
And it's amazing, because I certainly didn't bring that skill set into Alcoholics Anonymous.
No, that's right. And yeah, like, so I do sponsor women today. It's one of the most beautiful, you know, parts of my recovery. I got, I don't know if I can say, the person sitting opposite me, yes, is my sponsor today. At 8 years, I switched from my first sponsor and she moved overseas. And because I'd known you since early days and you'd been so, so incredibly honest with me, I felt safe. I knew that I was probably going to, you know, be able to generate some change by asking you to sponsor me, but also really love that that vulnerability and that honesty that you have, and I wanted to be able to learn how to do that. I lived in a world where if I couldn't predict the exact outcome, like, I don't like that. And, you know, so you sort of made things less or more predictable for me because you were so crazily honest, and I really like that. I now share it with sponsees. It's my responsibility as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous to be the hand of AA when somebody asks for my experience on how I got sober and how I stay sober, and also not how I just stay, like, as in, I don't want to just stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came here to change, you know. That means growth, that means seeking, that means always looking for new ways to enlarge my spiritual life. And yeah, and I'm modeled that behavior by the people ahead of me, including yourself, so thank you. And
and I guess that's the whole thing. We keep coming back because there's always something to change. Like, the things that over time, what's happened is that acceptable things in my life have become unacceptable.
Mm.
And so the problem is always me and how I perceive it. And and I get stuck in old ideas. And that's all language that comes straight out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. But that, you know, I need to be willing to make change. And because there's no treading water in AA, it's all you're either going backwards or you're going forwards.
That's right.
And I can't afford to go backwards anymore. Mm. And people expect me to be sober. Like, that's there's an expectation in my family that Michael is going to be sober and make grown up type decisions.
Yeah. And I know. I hate that. To my kids, I could really shake things up here if you like.
Like, let me revert to type, and then you'll be sorry.
Yeah. Exactly.
Thank you very much for coming in and having a chat today. It's all the time we've got. Thanks for sharing your experience.
Thank you for having me. We'll probably do this again,
I think. And next time I'll invite Chris, your husband, who's sitting next to us in the studio, but nodding his head and going,
he's got a story.
He can tell from the other side. So, thanks for coming in and have a chat. If you I've got some bits to read. If you'd like to find out more about Alcoholics Anonymous, then you can phone them on 1-300-222-222, or you can go online to aa.org.au. That's all the time we've got for today, and I'd like to thank Chrissy for coming in. I've done that and sharing her Alcoholics Anonymous recovery experience.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.